This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. The push to abolish slavery and achieve racial equality, the struggles for Cuban and Puerto Rican independence, efforts to unite people of African descent across national boundaries, the drive to write black people back into the history books. All this and much more was experienced, observed, and acted upon by a singular man named Arturo Alfonso Schomburg. A black Puerto Rican born in 1874, Schomburg moved from that island to New York City in 1891, where he participated in movements for Cuban and Puerto Rican independence and in struggles against racism. According to Jesse Hoffnung Garskoff, Schomburg's life on the color line, his direct knowledge and experience of racism both in Latin America and the U.S., and his resultant affinity with African Americans was paradigmatic for Afro-Latinos in the first half of the 20th century. Jesse Hoffnung Garskoff is an associate professor of history and American culture at the University of Michigan. He's contributed an article about Arturo Schomburg and the New York City he inhabited to the new volume, The Afro-Latina Latino Reader, History and Culture in the United States. When I spoke recently with Jesse, I asked him what achievements Arturo Schomburg is best known for.
He was a prolific collector of documents and books, almost entirely related to people of African descent around the Americas, as well as in Europe. And he's, I think, principally known for that collection, which he first put together as an amateur collector in his apartment in Brooklyn, using his own money, but then later donated to the New York Public Library, and it became, at the 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library, it became basically the most prominent worldwide center for the study of black culture and history, which is called the Schomburg Center now, and still there on 135th Street in Harlem.
And what interested you most about him in the context of this piece you wrote for this book, The Afro-Latina Latino Reader?
His intellectual accomplishments are fantastic. I mean, his collection and his involvement in the Harlem Renaissance and in other kinds of intellectual activity in New York were, before I got interested in them, these were the main things that people had studied about him, just his kind of prolific intellectual production. And I was really interested as a student of migration and of Latino migration in particular, and also a student of the Caribbean. I was really interested in his racial identity. I was very interested in the particular course that he took from his birth in San Juan to his death in New York City, both as a migrant, as a Puerto Rican migrant, but also as a person of African descent who negotiated over the course of his life his position within Puerto Rican society and then his position within the society of the United States. And I was really interested because he was kind of an unusual figure in that sense. We had a view, which I think is changing now, but a fairly standard view of Puerto Rican racial identity in which historians and sociologists and others have imagined that Puerto Ricans of African descent did not desire to make contact with African Americans in the United States until much later. And it turned out from Schomburg's story that, in fact, he did. He was a Puerto Rican of African descent who was very much engaged in international and Pan-African movements very early in the 20th century. But what the other thing that I found very interesting about him is that does not necessarily mean that he did not also participate in the kinds of movements that other Puerto Ricans of color were involved in on the island and in respect to Cuba, in which they were trying to build a nationalist movement which included both whites and blacks together as Puerto Ricans and as Cubans.
So he was, in a significant sense, cosmopolitan.
Oh, he was absolutely cosmopolitan. Absolutely, I agree with that characterization 100%.
Now, Schomburg was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, as you said. In 1874, his mother was of Danish West Indian origin, and his father was ethnic German. What else should we know about Schomburg's early life?
He was educated, as far as we can tell, at a religious institution, which is not uncommon. A lot of the religious institutions in the cities of the island were open to, at least at the elementary level, were open to children of color and children from non-elite backgrounds, right, working class kids. His mother, as far as we know, earned her living washing clothing, which was not an elite status. And the fact that she was able to send her child to school reflects both the openness of those institutions and also, of course, her great sacrifices to put him through it. But what's really interesting is after school, he seems to have apprenticed himself at a local print shop. He worked in a print house that was run by a man with liberal leanings. And what I've found is that he seems to have gotten engaged with intellectual life through his apprenticeship as basically a worker. A print shop worker was a working category like a barrel maker or a silversmith or a blacksmith, but had the one unique quality, which is that in order to do it, you had to be literate. In the act of doing it, you actually came into lots of contact with the world of ideas. And Schomburg wasn't the only man of his generation on the island who was of African descent and who really educated himself and became a public figure through apprenticeship at the type shop. And it, in fact, turns out, I've found out since this article appeared, that a number of the people who were organizers of the movement that he was a part of in New York City were also black or mulatto typographers who had gotten interested in journalism and history on the island in the process of typesetting the work of the leading liberal thinkers on the island.
Very interesting. When Schomburg moved to New York City in 1891, were there a lot of Puerto Ricans living there?
No, there were very, very few. There was a relatively small group of Puerto Ricans who were in New York for commercial reasons. That is to say, the people on the island who were involved in overseas trade, many of them kept a residence in New York City if their basic business was with the United States. But there was a relatively small, even smaller group of Puerto Ricans who were of working class origin. They were not rural laborers. They were, like Schomburg, urban working classes. But the real growth in Puerto Rican migration to the mainland comes after 1898 and actually even after 1917, after the beginning of World War I. So he was really in a very small community when he arrived.
Now, in New York City, Schomburg joined a Masonic lodge that had been founded by Cubans of African descent. Under what circumstances did the founders of that lodge leave Cuba?
The founders of the lodge that he belonged to, which was called the Sol de Cuba Lodge, the Sun of Cuba, sun in the sense of the rising sun, left Cuba for the most part in the 1870s. And the 1870s were a period, especially the late 1870s, were a period of significant turmoil in Cuba. There was a war of independence in Cuba, you know, 30 years before the War of 1898, which we're familiar with in the United States.
Starting the Spanish-American War.
The Cuban-Spanish-American War. But 30 years before the conclusion of that war, there was another war in Cuba which lasted for 10 years and was called the 10 Years War. It started in 1868 and ended in 1878. And it was a kind of a remarkable struggle. It started out with a group of white Cuban-born, what we call Creole white slave owners, who decided that they needed to separate from Spain in order to pursue their own self-interest in the same way that the white slave owners of the U.S. South, you know, wanted to separate from England. But unlike the slave owners of the U.S. South, or what became the U.S. South, in the process of declaring their independence, they actually decided to manumit or free their slaves and invited the freed slaves to join them in the struggle for free Cuba. And of course, they did this with the imagination that they would remain basically in control and that the slaves would join in a kind of auxiliary way to their masters and would be so grateful for the manumission that they would never, you know, make any demands for equality. But that's not the way wars work. And after 10 years of war, many, many of the people who had been previously enslaved, as well as many people who had been previously free but were of African descent, had worked their way up through the military ranks. And in fact, some of the leading generals of the war, including a man named Antonio Maceo, were men of African descent. And so what happened was, eventually Spain was able to break the rebellion in many ways by splitting off the original white Creole supporters from the more radical working class and African descended warriors or soldiers who had and leaders who had come to the fore in the process of this really radically transformative movement. So in 1878, when the first group of Cubans are really starting to populate New York City, many of them were exiles who had either been participants in the struggle of 1868 to 1878, or especially those who were African descended, were men who really resented the peace that had been signed in 1878 and felt it had betrayed the ideals of the movement, in particular that it had not achieved the end of slavery in Cuba, which was one of the main ideals that the movement had proposed.
So were you saying that the issue of the abolition of slavery was intimately tied to the issue of Cuban independence in the mind of many revolutionary leaders, at least for a time?
For most of the time. I think the rebellion in Cuba, including the white Creole wealthy planters who were part of the rebellion always officially linked the two things. And that was one of the ways that they recruited many, many soldiers from free black and many enslaved soldiers on the island. And as those soldiers joined the ranks, they offered their own definitions of what freedom should mean, right? So the end of slavery can mean many things, as we know. It can mean anything from a very limited form of citizenship to full citizenship for the people who had been freed. And so there was a general consensus about the idea that liberty should come, you know, that the end of slavery should come with independence, but there was an increasing divergence about what that liberty should mean, and that divergence ends up splitting the movement, and the peace that gets signed between the leaders of the insurgency, many of whom are white and Creole, and the Spanish authorities is a peace that agrees that does not include the end of slavery. So those who are dissidents, those including many of the men who came to New York, they felt as if their one-time allies had betrayed a shared goal of the end of slavery, as well as a shared goal of the independence of Cuba. And so, for example, when the men who formed the Masonic Lodge that Schomburg eventually a decade later will join, when they're forming that lodge in Brooklyn in 1880, given who they are and where they came from, we can be fairly certain of what their view of the peace signed in 1878 was. And we can be fairly certain that they felt that it was basically a treason to the Cuban cause, both because it did not satisfy their demands for independence, but also and especially because it did not satisfy their desire and very, I think, well-founded desire to end slavery and to create a Cuban national identity that would be inclusive of and respect the rights of the people descended from Africa and Cuba.
Jesse Hoffman-Garskoff joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He's Associate Professor of History and American Culture at the University of Michigan. We are talking about an article he wrote, The World of Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, in the new volume, The Afro-Latina Latino Reader, History and Culture in the United States. Did the founders of Sol de Cuba, and again, this is the Masonic Lodge that Schomburg joined in New York City. Did the founders, these Cubans, did they affiliate themselves with the sort of Cuban Masonic establishment in New York City at the time?
No, they didn't. There were multiracial Cuban lodges in New York that had emerged as part of the movement. They were oftentimes either formally or informally linked to the independence movement that had existed for 10 years in Cuba, and that I think probably right before the Sol de Cuba lodge members formed their own lodge, were probably experiencing some tensions within those lodges as a result of the breakup of the movement in Cuba. And so what's really interesting is that the Sol de Cuba founders, rather than joining that multiracial Cuban lodge that was still mostly run and operated by white Cubans with the secondary participation of black and brown Cubans, they actually form their own lodge and they apply to the Prince Hall Masons, which is the African-American, at the time known as the Negro Masons in the United States. Masonry in the United States was segregated in a way that mainstream masonry in Cuba was not. And so rather than join the mainstream Cuban form, they join the African-American branch of North American masonry. To me, that's fascinating because it's a moment where the tensions, where, as I identify them, the tensions that exist within this Cuban movement, the men of color in New York who are involved in those tensions are able to find an outlet and an independent kind of base of activism and organizing for themselves, or even socialization for themselves, through a diasporic contact, which is to say, through a contact that they make with other people of African descent from another context that they have moved to. And to me, that's a kind of a key moment for understanding the world that Schomburg comes from.
Yeah, there's a suggestion that Schomburg and his colleagues, his comrades at Sol de Cuba Lodge, that somehow joining or becoming affiliated with the mainstream Cuban Masonic establishment would somehow constrain them or limit their activity or viewpoint.
I think that that's true. I think it's a difficult point to make. It's not that the mainstream Cuban lodges that were available to them in New York were wholly opposed to racial equality. Many of them were actually formally in their liturgy. I've seen the kinds of things that they were reading to each other in their secret meetings were supporting the notion of racial equality, right? Which is actually quite remarkable, especially if you compare it to mainstream U.S. lodges, which were segregated, right? But I do see a parallel between what goes on in New York and what's going on the island, which is that in the wake of the peace that was signed in 1878, you see a proliferation in Cuba of new organizations that are formed by men of color and that are designed for socialization with other men of color. And these have political outlets. They become places for leading men of color to mobilize political support for particular political parties that they want to affiliate with. They also have intellectual bases. They tend to be places where there are literary readings and where there are sometimes there are newspapers that are published with them. And they also have political valence, which is to say that these are men who have been involved in a struggle alongside white allies, and they recognize that that alliance is tenuous and is difficult, and they see these independent bases of organizing as offering an opportunity for them to engage in the alliances from a position of greater strength, right? They can engage in these alliances, they can participate in the alliances that sometimes constrain their claims as black men. Sometimes they have to say, yes, we are Cubans, we will conform to the will of the Cuban people as a whole, and not mention the fact that we have our own concerns as a minority within the Cuban community. They can do that while still being able to resort to use their own institutions in order to make stronger claims about their rights and for advancement. And I think that that's what happens in New York, too. This group of Cuban activists and migrants, they find a way by creating their own, basically, society of color, which is what they're called on the island, their own Masonic lodge, which they control, and in which they can set the terms of the way that race and civilization and masculinity will be defined. They do it by affiliating themselves with the African-American branch of Masonry rather than joining the Cuban branch of Masonry. And I think this becomes a base of their power when they then do still engage with white Cubans in New York. They can do so from a base of independent social organizing.
Did Schomburg and his colleagues at this Cuban Masonic Lodge, did they associate much with whites in their neighborhoods and social circles?
It's obviously really hard to tell what they did on a day-to-day basis, but I have evidence for a couple of things. It's clear that they did maintain ties with white Cubans in their places of work. Many of them were cigar workers, and most of the cigar factories, as far as we know, the Cuban cigar factories in New York at this time had an integrated workforce. And so in their class-based politics, that is, as workers, when they organized with respect to their bosses, they lived in a multiracial world. And a multiracial world that was at least theoretically committed to racial equality, although that, as we know, theoretical commitments to racial equality don't always translate into actual equality, but there was a theoretical commitment there. We also know that they socialized with white Cubans in their political organizations, especially into the 1890s. But the thing that I found in doing this research, which was so surprising, I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but it was so novel when I discovered it, is that if you look at the U.S. Census, you can find that in their personal lives and in their residential patterns, the Cubans and then the Puerto Ricans who joined them and were part of this Masonic movement, for the most part, lived in parts of the city that were mostly populated by other people of African descent, most of whom weren't Cuban. Most of them were either from the United States or from the English-speaking Caribbean. So if you look at where the members of the lodge were living, they were working with white Cubans. They were oftentimes in class-based organizations with white Cubans, but they were living among blacks. And even beyond that, it wasn't just that there were Cuban families living in buildings that were reserved for blacks, but in fact, many of them were forming families with the people that they were living among. So there were at least five or six of the founding members that I could identify before they even founded the lodge had married African-American women from the United States and had basically established households that were arranged along the lines of a kind of an African diaspora unity, even as they were working in factories that were aligning along kind of multiracial class unity, and as they were engaged in a political struggle that was aligning along a multiracial national unity as Cubans.
His name is Jesse Hoffman Garskoff. He teaches history and American culture at the University of Michigan. He's author of A Tale of Two Cities, Santo Domingo and New York After 1950. And he wrote an interesting article about Arturo Alfonso Schomburg for the new volume, The Afro-Latina Latino Reader. Schomburg was a black Puerto Rican born in 1874. Who moved to New York City and actively participated in movements for Cuban and Puerto Rican independence and in struggles against racism based on notions of unity among people of African descent. You write or you cite certain studies, Jesse, that indicate that Puerto Ricans of African descent at that time in New York City generally refused to associate with African Americans, who they saw as having to deal with so much racial prejudice. And what you're saying here is that Schomburg and some of his colleagues really defied that kind of conventional behavior.
I guess what I'm saying is two things, because that is true. There has been in the historiography, in the way that historians have written about this period, a presumption that as a kind of a starting point, Puerto Ricans, both for reasons of their own racial identities that they carry with them from the island, and also for the reason of trying to avoid the segregation and the discrimination that's imposed upon African Americans in this period, that they try and avoid, quote, being mistaken for black, right? That there's a kind of a sense that to the extent that they can fold into a Latino category or a foreign category, they will, to try and avoid the kinds of oppression that are imposed upon African Americans from the English speaking world. And I think that I think that Schomburg really offers a kind of an exception to that, to the extent that that was a pattern. And then when you look at Schomburg in the context of this broader world, where there are Cubans and Puerto Ricans of color who are actively engaged with African Americans, does tend to kind of break down that presumption. But I do want to be careful about it, because part of what they're doing is by choice, and part of what they're doing is by force, right? I don't want to suggest that they're living in African-American neighborhoods simply because they chose to. I mean, I think it's probably pretty clear that they do because there are forces that segregate them, right? They may not have the opportunity to live in other parts of the city. And they may also have limited choice in romantic partners as well. But I think that some of the things that they're doing, some of the choice to join social organizations, some of the evidence that I've been able to collect about their political engagements, political alliances with African Americans, and clearly the social world, the Masonic social world, and other kinds of places where it seems like they actually are consciously making a decision both to engage with African Americans, but also very clearly to think about and compare the conditions for people of African descent in the various societies that they're living in, right? So they're becoming, as you said, cosmopolitans. They're becoming comparativists and thinking about the different models for political activism, the different models of racism, and trying to figure out how to insert themselves and use those models to their advantage in the different societies that they're living in.
You write in this article about the Cuban Revolutionary Party and its activities in New York City and the ways in which Arturo Schomburg became involved with the party. A key leader in that party, in the Cuban independence struggle, was the exiled José Martí, who lived for a number of years in New York City. You write that Martí was a symbol of enlightened white leadership. How so?
So Martí came out of this world of Masonic teachings about race that I've already mentioned, right? He came out of the world of the Ten Years' War, and he came out very clearly of the world of New York City in this period. He was a friend to and in many ways a close ally of some of the leading Cuban leaders in the city. And the combination of all of those contacts led him to develop an idea about Cuban nationality and race that was really kind of unusual for white nationalists in this period. So he very clearly argued that race should not be a factor in national identity, that basically the national project should put blacks and whites on equal footing, and that everybody should come to the table and everybody should be included based on a shared national identity, and the idea of racial division should be left behind. And he actually also, unusual in the 1890s for white intellectuals in the Atlantic world, most of whom believed some version of scientific racism, he argued that the difference between blacks and whites, to the extent that there was one, was not a biological difference or a scientific difference, but rather a difference based on social prejudice. So to the extent that blacks, for instance, had less education in Cuban society, this was because social prejudice had prevented them from fulfilling their potential. And so he argued that the Cuban nation should allow everyone to fulfill his potential. He mostly talked in terms of men. His potential at the same time that it recognized the participation of all sectors of society. And for the black Cubans and Puerto Ricans who joined the movement that he led, his leadership was really fundamental because they saw him as being a kind of a crucial link between themselves and their own project of racial advancement and this now bigger nationalist project that was reformulating in the 1890s.
José Martí famously said that in a liberated Cuba, there would be no blacks or whites, only Cubans. And this kind of color blindness espoused by Martí was not without disadvantages. What were they?
I think the clearest disadvantage is that Marti's idea that there should be no blacks nor whites, very similar to some of the kind of post-racial ideas that we encounter nowadays in U.S. society, can sometimes, and sometimes even frequently, become a way of excluding conversations about the really existing inequalities in society, right? So once there's a kind of an accepted nationalist discourse that race should not be a factor in conversations, then when people of color rightfully raise the existing racial discrimination that they face or the long way to go that the nation has to actually fulfilling its promise, it's possible for people who are not sympathetic to racial equality to say, wait a second, we shouldn't talk about that. That's racist. We're beyond race in the society. And, you know, I think of Stephen Colbert, who's, I think, is a great satirist of this, where he says in his interviews, I don't see race, so I don't even know if I'm white or black. He's satirizing a real predicament that these kinds of cross-racial alliances offer, because, you know, especially in the context of the 1890s in the United States, where Jim Crow is on the rise, where the ostensible allies of racial equality, the Republican Party in the United States, is backing off from its commitment to racial equality and to full citizenship, you know, where lynching is on the rise, the idea of a nationalist movement that is even abstractly committed to racial equality is quite alluring and very powerful, and offers black activists their own leverage to say, wait a second, you can't be racist, that's against the national norm, that's against our joint project. But it does so by asking them also at moments, and sometimes in very, very key ways, to give up a certain amount of power to organize themselves independently. It asks them to do that. They, of course, never actually give up their independent organizations, but it asks them to renounce the idea that they will organize themselves as a race and to basically present themselves only as Cubans.
Jesse Hoffnung-Garskoff joins us today on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. He is Associate Professor of History and American Culture at the University of Michigan, where his areas of interest include modern Latin American and Caribbean history, Latino studies, international migrations and transnationalism, music and popular culture, and poor people and social movements. We'll take a short music break and speak more with Jesse. Please stay with us.